Hey everybody, it's another day on the Priest and the Rabbi.
It's another day in paradise.
It's another day in paradise with two clerics. Judeo-Christian clerics. Hey buddy.
So.
Hey.
Hey.
How
are
you
doing
today?
Excellent.
Great.
Wonderful.
So. Today
is
a wonderful
show
about
biblical
heroes
who
are
challenged
and
broken.
Period.
Full stop.
Then
they
will
explore
many
different
ways
of
redemption
and
growth
throughout
the
experiences
of
life.
Period.
Full stop. So I'm really inspired about today's show. For those that have been following us, we are looking at biblical characters with their brokenness and what lessons do we learn from our biblical heroes? What were their downfalls? What would we look forward for them to impress upon us? Looking at in a modern day context of which we would like to, if had the fortunate opportunity to meet, to greet, to date, to have a cup of coffee with,
to date your daughter,
or to potentially stand 500 feet away from my property.
Yeah. So we'll get into all that. And then when we look at their brokenness, or when we look at these heroes, what do we learn also just from their ups and downs? And so God intentionally made them this way. So what does that mean for you and me?
Mm-hmm.
And how does that inspire us to look at it? Not just say, these people are so broken, but like, hey, what do I learn from that? So yeah, it's going to be a fun episode today. It's going to be a fun episode. So the crowning moment of this podcast today is when you get to hear which character in the Bible that Rabbi Durbin is willing to date his daughter, one of his daughters, when she's probably 35. Is that when you're going to allow your daughters to date?
35, 45.
Yeah, that's fair. All right. Well, here at A Priest and Rabbi Podcast, please, we are so grateful that you tuned in. Please share this podcast with those who you know would like it so we can grow and build this community. And because we are so grateful for it, give us a rating, leave a comment on what you want to hear from in the future. And we're just grateful you're here. So God bless you and enjoy the show.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of the program hosts and their guests and are not necessarily those of WSTU, St. Mary's Episcopal Church, and Temple Beit Haim. Products that may be mentioned are not necessarily intended as an endorsement. Any reproduction or retransmission of this broadcast is strictly prohibited. And now, WSTU presents A Priest and a Rabbi. Call in with questions and comments at 220-9788. 220-WSTU. Now, here's your host.
Hey, 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 hey. Good morning. It is Father Christian Anderson from St. Mary's Episcopal Church in Stuart, Florida. And next to me is just the best darn looking rabbi you would ever see in this side of the Jordan River. It is Rabbi Matthew Durbin from Temple Beit Haim. And this is A Priest and a Rabbi on a Friday morning. We are so happy you're tuning in. Rabbi, good morning. How are you? What's happening? What's good?
I'm super. Good morning to you.
You look great. You smell great. The phone is ringing off the hook. You know, it's just nuts around here. You know, Rabbi, there's this thing coming up. You know, we were talking right before the show about there's an air show coming up. And Rabbi's like, man, I love to go to the air show. And I was like, yeah, man. Hey, listen, you can get free tickets. And he's like, how can you get free tickets? I was like, my church has free tickets for anyone who wants to work the booth. And he's like, well, great. Whose booth? I'm like, St. Mary's has a booth. He's like, St. Mary's has a booth? I was like, yes. He's like, how'd you guys get a booth? I was like, well, the announcer, Barry Marsh, is a parishioner. I said, so we give away tickets to people who are willing to work our booth. So what are you ready for this, Rabbi? Are you ready to work the booth for St. Mary's Episcopal Church and act like a parishioner? And you might have to pray for people. And when you pray for people, you do have to say it in the name of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I don't know if I can do that, but the air show, it's an interesting...
What if you prayed for people and you said in the name of our Lord?
I mean, it's what I do every day of my life.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, listen, I mean, they're not going to call you a Jew for Jesus. They're just going to call you like a Jewish friend of St. Mary's Church.
No, and you know, I like the idea of having a booth. I mean, we could just scratch out the St. Mary's name and put a Temple Beit HaYam. Or we could say St. Mary's in collaboration with, in partnership with Temple Beit HaYam.
Okay, so what are you bringing to the table?
Bringing me.
What else?
Isn't that enough?
I don't know. Some good food? Some people love kids.
Some hummus?
Some hummus, yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm the Lebanese priest. You're the Jewish rabbi. We could have a hummus battle.
We could.
Israel and Lebanon still fighting over the hummus battle. Who created it first?
Yeah.
Yeah, among other things they're fighting over.
It's all those chickpeas.
Yeah, chickpeas and Hamas.
So, you know, it's
gotta laugh
out. You know, it's always interesting when it comes to the air show, because we have major challenges with the air show every year. And it, just because of our proximity to where our temple is to where the air show is, which is, you know, a stone throws away. And every single time, because the air show, of course, goes on a Friday night and goes Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And every time that either I'm in mid-prayer.
Oh, sure.
What do I hear? It sounds like thunder and the planes are going overhead, and literally have to stop the liturgy to wait, you know, the 25, 30 seconds in order for there to be that just kind of brief reprieve of silence so we can continue with the service.
I mean, your temple is right next door to the field.
Yes.
I mean, you guys are, yeah, you're getting exhaust fumes during the service.
Well, the nice thing, too, is that you can join us for Shabbat morning services and the air show at 9 o'clock.
At the air show?
No, at our temple.
Oh, okay.
But you might as well be at the air show, because sure, we're right there. You know, what we can do is literally go out to our courtyard and just look up. I mean, we see the planes going, so it's almost like a free show.
You guys need to get a booth. It's worth the investment. Get someone in your congregation to underwrite it, and then you just set up a booth and just put a big arrow pointing, saying, "See that building over there? That's us.
Come join us.
Come join us. Don't be afraid of the Jews. We're right there. We're
have
cool."
Have you been? I mean, obviously, you've been to the air show.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
What do you think about it?
I mean, I grew up in Chicago. We had an air show on the ocean. I mean, not on the ocean, on Lake Michigan.
So you heard it first. Reverend Anderson said, "There is an ocean in Chicago."
I retract that statement. Yeah, I mean, it's cool. I mean, it's, yeah,
I mean, Lake Michigan could be an ocean.
Sure,
for some.
To some it was, and you know, when I was a kid, I probably thought it was. Yeah, I mean, it's cool. It's great. You know, I mean, it's a lot of gas being used. You know, I think the green part of myself is just like, I mean, sometimes this sounds terrible. It's sort of like a big commercial for the, you know, the Air Force or something. Mm-hmm. But it's, I mean, people love
it. It's exciting.
Yeah.
To just watch those planes and, you know, the different types of models and everything else. I think it's a lot of fun. This year, I think I'm going to commit myself and bring my kids to the air show. I think it's a lot of fun.
Hey, okay.
I've never been.
If you want to come and be a friend of St. Mary's, you can stand in the booth and be like, this church is so cool that even a rabbi and his family feel comfortable hanging out and talking about the church.
Did you give me some lentil soup?
I'll give you some tickets. How about that? You bring the lentils.
I feel like I want some nice lentil
soup. My gosh, you've run a hard bargain. All right, so today on the show of A Priest and a Rabbi, we got our producer back, Miggity Mike. Miggity Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
How you feeling, brother?
Much better.
Okay, we were talking about broken heroes last week, so you were our broken hero because you're a hero, but then you were broken with sickness.
I was broken.
How is the mad cow? Are you better?
Oh, it is definitely, the hoof and mouth disease is gone.
It's
and we're good to go.
All right, good, because you know I hope you don't kiss your wife with that mouth, with the
yeah.
Love of mouth.
No.
Okay. All right, man. Well, welcome back, brother. All right. So today, you know, last week we got into this thing about broken heroes. So all these heroes of the Bible that we look to that get mentioned a lot, that are lifted up, usually have some pretty serious tragic flaws. And last week we first focused on David and about how he wasn't winning Husband of the Year award anytime soon, wasn't really a great friend in some places, and sometimes a questionable leader in how he treated his own people, but still looked at as one of the greatest leaders of the Jewish people in the Hebrew scriptures. So this week, and then we went from there and we parlayed into some of these, like, would you rather, you know, so would you rather have this person or this person date your daughter, right? So that got a lot of comments and people really into that. So we're going to continue with that this week. And so we're going to first focus on Moses and Moses as a hero, and look at his brokenness, and what do we learn and grow from that as followers of Holy Scripture. And then we're going to get into some would-you-rathers, like And also some who are the greatest. So we're going to assemble our greatest. If the Bible had a basketball team, who would be your starting center, your power forward, your small forward, your point guard, and your shooting guard? We're going to talk about who is the greatest prophet of all time, the greatest. Who is the greatest failure of all time? Who would you rather date your daughter? Who would be your presidential ticket, and what would be their slogan? And who would be your best road trip partner? So all that is coming up here. So if you have some answers for that, give us a call here at 772-220-9788. And you can also always catch us on the podcast, A Priest and a Rabbi. It's the one that has a lot of episodes. All right. So, Rabbi, let's talk about some Moses. Moses, as we know, looked up, as many would say, as the greatest prophet of all time. Jews dig him. Christians dig him. Even Muslims dig him. The Baha'i folks look at him and say, hey, this guy's pretty cool. You and I were talking yesterday about this idea of, yeah, but he killed a man. He killed a man, and he also struggled with leadership and a step into leadership. So as we all know, there's a purpose to everything that God is using here, and there's a reason why God uses a man like Moses to be one of the greatest prophets of all time. So let's first start with the killing. What do we do with that? He killed a man. That's a sin.
I think, especially, you know, when we look when yeah. we look at Moses as that experience that shapes Moses in terms of, you know, killing the Egyptian taskmaster who's beating a Hebrew slave. I think we got to go back. I think we got to go back all the way back to the beginning,
Adam,
of the Moses saga.
Okay.
Right, so when we go back to that saga, you know, Moses is a baby. He is put in a basket, as we know from the very famous story in Exodus. Right, firstborn child is to be for the firstborn Hebrew child is to be drowned in the Nile. Right, and it's a very interesting understanding in terms of Moses' name itself. So in Hebrew, his name is Moshe. And Moshe means he who was drawn from water, which is interesting that water, which was supposed to kill him, ultimately saved him.
Right.
Right. And we go a little bit further with the plagues, right? After the plagues, when they are running to the Sea of Reeds, right? It's the water that saves the Israelites as God parts the sea. And the water, which is perilous, that drowns the Egyptians. But to take it back to Moses, he's a baby, and Pharaoh's daughter sees him in this basket in the Nile River, and carries him, brings him back, and raises him in Pharaoh's court, which means that the rights, the privileges, the experience that Moses has is not the same as the enslavement of the Israelite nation.
He's got a life of privilege going.
Absolutely, right? So he lives this life of luxury. And as he climbs in age and stature and everything else, and then he sees at this moment, an Egyptian taskmaster violating and beating a Hebrew slave. And Moses then takes it upon himself and kills the Egyptian taskmaster.
He looks left, he looks right, and then kills him.
No, other way around. He kills the taskmaster, then looks right and left, and then flees. Right? Almost as if he's looking for witnesses. Who can test me?
Actually, verse 12, glancing this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian.
Oh, okay. So this is fact-checking 101.
Well, I mean, I figured we'd be talking about it. Might as well bring the scripture with us.
Sure.
The holy word is always good.
But interesting that he looks right and left.
Uh-huh.
Right? So almost as if I'm about to do something that is unbecoming of me.
Sure.
And I'm looking for witnesses, and I'm going to do it.
Right.
Right? So when he kills the taskmaster, he doesn't stick around. He flees. He flees to Midian.
Not right away.
No. But he takes this opportunity.
He waits a day.
Okay.
He waits a day, and then when he sees the two Hebrews fighting, he's like, "Hey, man, can we all just get along?" And they're like, "What are you gonna do? You know, like they are you thinking because since you killed the Egyptian, you're gonna kill one of us?" That's when he freaks out. So he doesn't feel guilty until the next day, mm-hmm. or doesn't even I wouldn't even say guilty. He feels conscious of like, "Oh, he feels threatened of his security, that these mm-hmm. people are going to rat him out. That's when he gets in the getaway car and, mm-hmm. and goes to Midian. So he, you know, he's not feeling too bad after it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be not feeling bad. And I'm not saying this is why he's this broken guy, but he's probably feels pretty good about what he did, because he's finally stepping into his own. I mean, that's where I think he's like, wait a minute, this is my people. This is my calling. There's got to be a calling just happening inside of him saying, this is what I'm called to do. I'm not to live this life of luxury. It says, like, you know, he finally got to sneak in and see what's actually happening to his people. And he's like, wow, I'm going to take this into my own hands, which I think is his real sin. I'm going to take this into my own hands and I'm going to kill this guy. And then the next day, when his own people he's trying to save are the ones who are saying, throw it right back in his face. He's like, oh, you guys are going to sell me out. He that's when he bolts.
But he takes the extreme, right? He doesn't say to the taskmaster, hey, buddy, stop. You're being a little over the top.
Do you think that would have worked?
Well, it's not like he's some random person who's saying that to a taskmaster.
That's true.
The taskmaster knows exactly who Moses is and Moses' stature, where he stands.
Sure.
Right? Moses could have interceded and just said, you're a little severe, perhaps.
I'm going to need you to tone it down, bro.
Go take a break. Go take a breather. Go count to 10.
Grab a cigarette.
Go grab a cup of coffee, right? Grab a seat. Breathe deeply, come back, and reconvene.
Well, and we'll rethink this whole slavery structure we got going on here. Yes. It's fine. We'll convene all the leaders of the court here. Yeah, I mean, would you agree, though, that because a lot of people say, was it a sin that he killed the taskmaster? And to me, part of it seems like that he – I was reading some dude – I forget what's – some. Guy who calls himself a theologian, but it was a good point. He said that the sin that Moses committed at that point was taking upon God's work. So taking a life of another person, that's God's work. And so, you know, he's a young guy. I don't know what we think at this age. He's like 40 or something like that. I don't know. The 40 was like the new 15 then. So, you know, he's this young guy. He's full of that angst. He's full of that. Maybe he taps into some part of this, some Jewish pride there, and says, I got to take care of this, you know, and I'm the one who stepped in. I'm supposed to the one who's supposed to save my people, and just kills this guy where he's not waiting upon the Lord. He's not waiting upon the Lord to do the work. Because we all can see, if we look down, wait for the end of the story, God's going to take care of that. God's going to send the plagues. God's going to open up an ocean. Open up a sea, close the sea. He'll kill the people. He'll take care of that. That's not your job. Your job is just to be a leader and step into it. But Moses takes it upon himself, and still God says, all right, yeah, you screwed up, but we can do this in Midian too. And sure, I can show up in a bush and I'll start talking to you. I mean, I'm God. I can do whatever I want, even though you kind of screwed the pooch on this right at the beginning. Well, let's make this work. But would you agree that maybe his biggest sin was trying to maybe take upon God's work on his own? But that would have to necessitate that Moses knew the story and knew was taught by someone,
or the fact that Moses also knew God. Right.
Okay.
Because,
tell me more.
Because our biblical story has this understanding that when Moses flees to Midian, right, and as he's there and he sees this burning bush, that's the moment to which God calls Moses, that Moses and God engage in an interaction, to which, of course, we know the very famous, you know, what does Moses say to God? How am I supposed to reveal? How are people going to believe me? What is your name? Who are you? God, of course, says, I am. Which I am.
Yeah.
Right? Which is
I'm a verb,
very,
dog.
Very, very vague. But I think that there's something there of Moses as a character in terms of how we are supposed to learn the lesson. What lesson do we learn from that story? And I take it from the perspective that I what it embodies for me is Moses is just a regular, run-of-the-mill guy who sees injustice being done and like you said, takes it upon himself to rectify the situation.
Goes a little overboard.
This isn't right. Right? What is this taskmaster doing? He's beating this Hebrew slave for more productivity. Right? Work harder. Work harder. You're lazy. You're this, you're that, and the other. Work hard. We need these things to be done. We need certain things. And if you're going against the norm of what we expect, there are consequences. And Moses sees that as, that's a little severe. So I'm going to intervene in it.
And I think that that interaction sets the stage for Moses as the beginning of his leadership ability.
And his leadership ability of the Jewish people. Right, of the Jewish people. I don't think that it's just because this guy was just beating a slave. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was just, well, hey, that's wrong. We as human beings don't do that. He's being raised up to stand up for his people. I mean, isn't that part of it? There's one scholar was talking about the verb, and you're going to know this better than I do, but the yatsa, to break out, mm-hmm. to escape, to pull away. And that's the Hebrew word that's used during this moment, that there is this moment where he can break out of his shell, that he's been living this life of privilege, he's been living with the royal court, and now he can step into who he really is. This is the moment of the movie where the hero realizes who he's really truly called to be, and he's called to be a leader of these people. But my question about Moses is, where does he get it? Is it just a seed that's been planted inside of him? Because he didn't have time as a young boy to be raised by his parents where they can tell him the story that the Jewish people will be freed and be escaped from slavery. Did he get the scripture at some point? Did someone talk to him? Did he have one of the Jewish slaves come and talk to him and say, hey man, listen, we're going to get out of this. I don't know if you know about this. Where does he get the story? Does he know the story yet? Does he know that God is coming to save the Jewish people at some point? And then does he get the idea of maybe that's me? And that's why, or he has the hope of that. And so when he sees something happening, of this injustice happening to one of his people, he's like, I got to step in now. Now it's time to shine.
But I think the question too is, does Moses at that moment recognize within himself that he is different?
Right.
That he's not Egyptian. That ultimately he is of...
Yeah, it says he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Mm-hmm. So he knows that. Mm-hmm. Glancing this way and that, he's seeing no one. He killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. It's like Las Vegas style. The next day he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew? So he's got this. He's part of the people. This is an ethnic thing. Like he's like, well, why are we doing this to one another? We got to stick together here. And then they say, who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?
But interesting how that phrase, who made you, right, judge and arbiter over us, which you go, I don't know, 40 chapters later, he is the judge.
Yeah, exactly.
He is it. So, you know,
foreshadowing.
It's foreshadowing everything that will transpire. You know, it's there's an interesting... and I know we talk about this many times throughout the show, of Midrash, right? The stories the rabbis created that fill in the biblical gaps. And one of the Midrash that is used is this understanding that, you know, in the biblical sense, we understand that Moses is not permitted into the land of Israel because he struck the rock, not the first time, because the first time he gives credence and he gives authority to God. This is an act of God who will give you water, right? Because they're complaining, we're starving, we're thirsty. We went from a land of everything in Egypt to a land of nothing. Of course, the second time he strikes the rock, the people see that as an act of humanity, an act of man, rather than an act of God, right? And from there, the biblical story tells us that that's why Moses is not permitted in the land of Israel. But the Midrash actually says that when Moses was not permitted into the land of Israel because when he flees to Midian, he denies his Hebrew ancestry. And God says, because you denied who you are, you shall not
enter. So when he flew the coop, that was not a good thing.
No.
Okay.
But we have two different scenarios here, right? One is the biblical story that he flees, right? And that he has the encounter and the experience with God and then comes back and, you know, says his very, famous lines. Well, he doesn't say it, but Aaron says it to Pharaoh, right? Let my people go. And if you don't, then there will be these horrendous plagues that will be afflicted upon kingdom of Egypt. Right. But then there's the other flip side, which is what would happen if Moses
stayed in Egypt?
Stayed in Egypt.
Well, yeah, because Pharaoh was coming for him, because it says that When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian. So, but then again, that's the whole trust. That's the whole thing about the whole the Bible for everything. It's this trust in the Lord. Trust in the Lord, wait for the Lord. And so when Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled. So he didn't wait for God to protect him. He followed his fear. So from a Christian perspective, it's sort of like Judas, right? Judas falls into his fears. He flees. He freaks out from the Roman authority. The Romans are coming for us, Jesus. Chill out. You got to calm this down, this whole Jesus movement. And then Jesus is like, man, we're just going for it. This is kingdom talk here. And so Judas freaks out and he turns himself into the Roman authorities. He says, hey man, I'll sell my man out. And then he feels terrible about this, right? So it's this fear thing that can capture us where we don't trust in life that God's got this. And we just fly, we escape, we run. I mean, it happens, it's a temptation for a lot of us. Instead of just staying in the moment and saying, okay, God, What can God take care of the situation, and can I trust God? Or maybe it's not that. It's also sometimes we just try to take care of it ourselves, and we first don't turn to God to say, God, please help me in this situation. I just killed this man. Not a good move. If you want me to stay here and deal with this, you will protect me. And if you want me to run, you'll push me. But instead, his sin is he just first takes it in his own hand, kills a person, and then second decides I'm going to run. And to your point, God doesn't like that later on.
But it's interesting that you know, are we really pouring our prayers to God by saying, correct the situation, make things better? Or are we saying to God, give me strength. Give me strength to endure the challenges that lie ahead. And I think Moses says in some way, innerly, if that's even a word, give me strength. Give me strength.
He does say this?
No, I'm saying, you know, in a emotional, spiritual way, I think Moses is saying to God, especially when he sees God or experiences God in Midian, give me strength. Give me strength. I'm not the leader that you need. Sure. Right? You want to choose me. I'm not the right person. And I love the fact that Moses says that. I love the fact that Moses says, choose somebody else. I'm not fit. I'm not fit for this. I'm just a regular guy. And I think God says, there's a reason I chose you, buddy. Because you are a regular guy. And what that will show is that you're not extraordinary at this moment. I think later we can certainly both agree that Moses is an exceptional and just incredible leader. But like us, or all of humanity, it takes work. It takes time. We have to nurture it. We have to learn from our past mistakes. We have to learn from the challenges that we have and propel us to enhance what we already have, to improve ourselves. And I think Moses does that because in the beginning, he is not the leader that we look to at, you know, the end of Deuteronomy when he's standing on the banks of the Jordan River, that he is 120 years old. He has life experience. He's made his name. And I think, as you said, right, look, every Western faith has this image of who and what Moses is. You can't get around the world and mention the name Moses and people not know who you're talking about.
But the beauty of it, of Moses, is that looking at his full lifespan and how he came to be the great leader, which we need to preach on and talk about more because it gives more faith and to us as the normal everyday Joes and Sallys of the world to say that you got to put the work in. So God has put something upon your heart. And we live in a culture right now where it's like, if it's not happening now, oh gosh, or if you went out and tried it and you failed, then it's not meant to be, and you get insecure and you don't do it and you walk away from it. Where, let's look at Moses, man. He made some pretty big mistakes in the beginning. One of them, the worst you could ever make, he killed someone. And then by not trusting God and by trusting his fears and my trusting his own pride and taking life into his own hands, literally, but God continued to still work with him, and he even gave him everything he needed. He gave him Aaron and said, man, he could be your voice, this big insecurity that you have of yours. And eventually Moses grew into this great person. So I think for all of us, I think, you know, right now. So like,
but I like the fact, I love the fact that Moses rises to the challenge, right? God tells him to do something and he seemingly says, no.
So he doesn't rise to the challenge, actually. He's not seemingly, he says, I can't do that.
He says, I can't do it, Right, and the Midrash actually says, because, you know, the text makes it very unclear and very vague, right? That God speaks to Moses and says, I've chosen you, choose somebody else, right? But the Midrash says that
it's pretty clear, though. But Moses taps out.
We don't see in terms of length of time. We just think that it's a conversation, and finally Moses says, okay, God, fine. But the Midrash says that it was actually 7 full days of going backwards and forwards. Until finally Moses says, fine, I will take you up on the challenge. And I think that it's taking up on the challenge that, yes, God says, don't worry. I will appoint your brother Aaron as your mouthpiece. He will be the one that speaks to Pharaoh for you. You know, you just are my chosen person to whom I've picked. And I think what we see, especially with the plagues, when he speaks, is that Aaron speaks first. And as Moses almost starts rising to that challenge of, well, you know, it's like the person who says to a child or to a person, I don't think you can do this. Well, you've now given me more fire and more fuel for me to prove you wrong. And I think what Moses does is say, you know what, God, you challenged me. I'm going to, although not the right person.
God doesn't challenge him.
Well, he said, God says to him, I've chosen you.
And I've Moses chosen says, you. No, I mean, I think you're glossing over the part that he does tap out.
Yes.
He does tap out, and God has to kind of wean him and say, I'll give you everything you need. But I think for us, don't you think that's a better lesson for us all to know that even when we're trying to tap out, even when our humanity is overtaking us, our insecurities, our issues, I can't do this, that God is still always on our side. That God, I mean, we're all chosen ones. God has chosen us to be in this world, and that he will work with us if we can just kind of give in a little bit. We don't have to be totally all in at some point, because like Moses, it's just a little by little by little. But the story of Aaron, of him giving us the errands in our life, that to me, that's very comforting when I look at big projects I want to do in my life and I get really scared about, or I don't think I can do it. That God is saying, listen, okay, I'll walk with you on this. I'll give you everything you need. And it's going to take time. This is not going to happen overnight, brother.
But go, you know, even go back to early part of your ministry, right? When you were recently ordained as a priest, go back to that first sermon that you gave, as opposed to the sermons we give now, right? We see how we, through experience,
they've
become
gotten worse
more
and worse
more
and worse.
Right? You look at Moses as a character. He learns and he grows into his position, so that nearing the end, you know, he learns one of the greatest lessons from his father-in-law, Jethro, right? And Jethro says to him, Moses, don't be naive. Don't think that you can carry all the weight of the people on your shoulders. Appoint judges, magistrates, civil law, criminal law, right? He effectively starts the Supreme Court of the Israelite nation. So he appoints.
So God equips him. He gives him people. He gives him Jethro.
Gives him the ability to do so. And what Moses does, and I think that this is the lesson that we learned from Moses, is that a good leader is not one who takes everything on. A good leader and great leadership is one who is able to delegate, one who was able to communicate.
Uh-huh.
And I think we see that in the end. Moses was slow of speech, but nearing the end, Moses almost overcomes his impediment to become this leader that the Israelite nation needs. We need you, Moses, to be that powerful and influential leader that we need. And like you said, it takes time. Moses doesn't grow into this position overnight.
Right, exactly. So it's going to take time, and it's going to take time for us to get to this break. So I'm going to lead us into this break because Mike over here is about to fall asleep. Sorry, Mike, we got you, man. So listen, this is A Priest and a Rabbi talking about the brokenness of leadership and how Moses really had to stay in there and run the marathon. So I hope you guys are running the marathon with your growth into leadership. Stick around for part two of A Priest and a Rabbi here on WSTU 1450.
You're listening to A Priest and a Rabbi podcast. If you haven't done so yet, make sure to subscribe. And please leave a rating and a review, 5-star rating and a positive review if you can. We certainly appreciate it. That is the best way to make sure that others out there just like you can find this podcast. If you want to get in contact with Father Christian and Rabbi Durbin, you can do so by emailing apriestandarabbi@gmail.com. And the absolute best way to get a hold of the fellas is to call into the radio show. This podcast airs live on the radio every Friday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. on WSTU 1450. And you can listen live online at WSTU 1450.com. www.thehoofandmouthdisease.com. And if you want to join the show, you can call in to 772-220-9788. That's 772-220-WSTU.
Hey, everyone. This is Father Christian here on A Priest and a Rabbi. So happy for you to be here on this podcast with us. And I want to let you know that I have started a YouTube channel called Your Favorite Christian, and you can check it out on YouTube. And every Monday, I drop a new episode, and it's always through the lens of faith, but taking on different topics such as dating, relationships, marriage, pop culture. I've done one recently where I went out to the art show and talked about how do we find our relationship with God through all the what all the latest artists are doing. Last week was what do women really want in a man, and interviewing different people to be a part of that. So please check that out on YouTube. Subscribe, like, share, put on the notification so you get that every Monday. I also want to let you know of this podcast wouldn't be here if it wasn't for a generous donor from St. Mary's Episcopal Church who wishes to remain anonymous. All he asked, though, was that the information gets out that St. Mary's Episcopal Church here in Stuart has a healing center. And so you can call if you're looking for a counselor, someone to be there for you during a challenging time. And you can call the church at 772-287-3244. We also have a group of Stephen ministers who have been trained, over 50 hours of training, to be with you and walk with you during a time of crisis. They are not counselors. They are trained just to be more of the presence of Christ and walk with you during a time of crisis, whether it's a good crisis of having, oh my gosh, my daughter's about to get married, or if there's something a little bit heavier. So give us a call, 772-287-3244, and I thank that anonymous donor who makes this all possible. All right, God bless you, and enjoy the rest of the podcast.
Welcome back. And I'm not, am I on? I am on. Okay, I just can't hear myself. Welcome back. Father Anderson's just busy typing away.
I'm here, buddy. I'm here next to you. I'm always by your side.
Are you present?
I am, man. I'm the Aaron to your Moses. When you can't talk, which is like never, but when you can't, I'm here to fill in, buddy. I'm here. I will be easily the priest to your rabbi any day of the week.
As long as we're no doorman.
Well, you know, hey, the doorman, buddy. I'm doing the show again.
I heard.
You don't want to come see it again, do you? That's too much.
It's coming up soon.
November 3rd, buddy. I'm over at Starstruck Theater performing the one-man show. 27 characters, 60 minutes, one actor.
That's next Sunday.
Next Sunday, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. 6 p.m., everyone. Come over to Starstruck Theater and catch Your Favorite Christian doing a one-man show about how he went from being a nightclub doorman / actor to an Episcopal priest.
It takes time,
like Moses. Yeah, I figured it out. There was a lot of fall. I fell a bunch. Yeah. Nice tie in there, buddy. So go on Starstruck's website and buy a ticket. I stay for the talk back. I love to hear what you say. It's called Jesus Was Not a Doorman. That's the name of the one-man show. Autobiographical piece of mine. We sold it out last time. We did over Starstruck. The rabbi was there with his wife. He brought people from the temple, and no one was offended.
We Jews have thick skin.
Yeah. All right. So we spent the first half of the show, we were talking about Moses and brokenness and all that stuff, and now we want to get into what we did last time about other you know, we like to have fun in the second half of the show and talk about, like, would you rather or who's your greatest.
I thought we had fun through the entire show.
Well,
not just the first half. Well,
of course, but this one's a little more fun. It's a little more hypotheticals. We get to really, you know, kind of mix it up here. We've been talking about Moses as a great prophet, but let's break it down. Let's turn this into like a sports show. Who is the greatest prophet of all time according to Rabbi Durbin?
Greatest prophet. It's a great one.
Yeah, come on, man. Greatest prophet. There's 48 prophets and 7 prophetesses mentioned in the Bible. So which one of those is taking home the prophet crown from Rabbi Durbin? And why?
As I think about the question, there's a part of me that says, I think for me, I really, truly admire and am in slight awe of the prophet Nathan.
Talk to me, baby. Why Nathan?
So for those that don't know, you know, the prophet Nathan lived around the time of King David.
Uh-huh.
And the prophet Nathan was the one who came to David mm-hmm. and said that you shall not build God's holy temple
mm-hmm.
because you have blood on your hands.
Yeah.
Because you committed adultery. You committed murder, right? All the stuff with King David's relationship with Bathsheba. So the why. Why would I admire Nathan? Because I think for Nathan as a prophet to go to the king of Israel
mm-hmm.
and to say to him, because David was already, you know, he was poised. He's ready to build this temple. He wants to build this temple.
He's being eaten alive by his headphone cord right now.
Almost strangled myself. So I think for Nathan, just that knowledge of what is King David going to do? You know, I'm speaking on behalf of God, but I'm speaking to another human being. David could... He could
mm-hmm.
make me silent very quickly. He could kill me. He could put me aside. He could silence me.
To a prophet?
To a prophet. Would he?
Yeah. I mean, how many stories do we have of a king killing a prophet? I don't know. Can we get a fact check? If anyone knows that, can you call here? Michael, can you put that on the board?
Sure.
Can we get a vote on that?
On the board. On the board. I love it.
How many kings killed a prophet in the Bible? 220-9788. Give us a call and rescue us right now, please. All right, go ahead.
But I think that there's something really powerful about the fact that although the prophet, yes, speaking in the name of God, but the prophet takes that opportunity for Nathan to say something that to King David just utterly is soul-crushing to David. I'm not able to do what I want to do.
This is your favorite prophet because of this? He likes to crush souls?
No, because I think that he took that opportunity to speak to David and to outline what God had said and just unfearful of what David would do.
Okay.
And I think that quality of the strength of one's conviction, the ability to speak, which would be unfavorable material to somebody that would want something the other way, and to just take it on that level. I think there's something about the prophet Nathan that I think is really, really intriguing.
Okay, cool. All right, I'm with you, man. Listen, for me, as a Christian, I got to go with Isaiah. Isaiah is just constantly referring to the Messiah over and over again. And here's the thing about Isaiah. He's got this great balance of, yes, he's very straightforward. He's very truthful. He'll bring the doom and gloom, but he's also extremely inspiring and empowering. There's so many things that come out of Isaiah that, I mean, there's a reason why he's the most quoted prophet in the New Testament, because he talks a lot about the Messiah, but B, he's inspiring. Like, he's hopeful. Like, there's good news that comes from Isaiah. You read a lot of the prophets and, like, to be a prophet back in the day was not easy, man. You're like a jerk. Like, you have to say some things that are rough. Like, no one likes you. You got to be like the guy in the room. It's just like the if you ever have a prophetic voice today in the 21st century, no one likes you. You're the annoying guy on Twitter who's just saying things. We're like, oh gosh, will you stop it? You're just so much doom and gloom.
So you chose the prophet,
uh-huh,
who has 66 chapters to his book,
uh-huh,
which I love the fact you said that he says a lot of impactful 66 chapters. You're going to say something important.
Well, because everyone wanted more. If you're saying good stuff and empowering stuff, people want it. I mean, look at Joel Osteen. The guy has, you know, 18 million followers because he gives everyone self-empowerment. I'm not saying Isaiah is Joel Osteen, but he gives them hope. And so when you read Isaiah, whether as a Jew or as a Christian, that I think there's a lot of hope you can get from it. But at the same time, it's not like Joel Osteen, because there's many parts of Isaiah where he's going to punch you in the gut and give you some straight up hard news.
So let's take it from a different angle, right? So, you know, the prophet that you feel is the most important, the one that you look up to. What about the prophet that had the biggest fail, the one that you would prefer not to have that cup of coffee with, and why?
Well, I think for the greatest fail of all time, and I don't think he's looked at as a prophet, but he was giving a prophetic, mission, but Jonah, right? So Jonah, he's not a prophet, right? I don't think so. Hey, can you put that on the board? Miggity Mike?
It's up there.
Okay,
we're going to get it there.
Okay, great. Can we vote on that?
Yeah.
Jonah's a little bit different because at least in Hebrew scripture, Jonah's part of what we call ketuvim, writings.
Ketuvim.
Wisdom literature.
Okay, so in his great wisdom, but he's given a prophetic type thing. And his fail is that he thinks he can outrun God. So God comes to him and says, hey, I got this mission for you. Can you go be a prophet and tell this town of Nineveh that they're screwing it up and they need to change their things? And he runs the other way. And so the greatest fail is you can't outrun God.
But you can't outrun God.
Are you crazy? Here's the best part of it. He outruns God by getting on a Carnival cruise line and thinking that he could go out to sea and escape. When you're like the Blues Brothers, you got a mission from God, you got to go do it. And he thinks he could go jump on a cruise. And what do? They throw him off the cruise into the water, and then he gets swallowed by a big fish. So to me, that's fail, man.
But I love the understanding from Jonah, right? God says, go to Nineveh, go tell the people to go repent, go tell the king, right? If they don't, of their wickedness, I'm going to destroy the city. And what does Jonah do? Jumps on the boat and goes to Tarshish. Goes in the complete opposite direction.
Yeah.
What part don't you understand?
I told
you to go somewhere.
I know, but that's the fail, is that he's like, nope, runs. And the beauty of it is God's going to get you no matter what, and he has to go into the belly of the whale where it's dark, it's silent, it's isolated, and we all have to have those moments in our life where we just have to go into the belly of the whale and finally say, fine, God, I give up. Talk to me. I know you've been chasing me my whole life. Just take over my life, and I'll do what you want me to do. And, you know, that's really our adolescence. We're just running from God because we are totally into ourselves and just want to do what we want to do. All right, cool. How about this? Who would you want? Last week we talked about who would you date, you know? So this week, who would you allow to date your daughter or one of your daughters when she is of age? So when you allow your daughters to date at probably 35, who in the Bible would you allow to date your daughter?
I hope that my daughters would have. It's a great question.
Okay.
I have two?
That's weird.
No, I'm not saying two at the same time.
That's weird.
You're
a strange dad. I know you're a reformed Jew, but now we're getting a little weird here, buddy.
If I had to compartmentalize into two, into one. On the one hand, I like Isaac.
Okay.
And I like Isaac because he embodies in some degree some like maternal instincts. When he meets Rebecca, one of the first acts that Isaac does is he brings her into his mother's tent. And there's something maternal there. There's something that he wants to connect with. And I think if my daughter were to date somebody, I want somebody to give her the respect, certainly nurture and have that strong sense of compassion. So I see Isaac on the one end.
He's not threatening. I mean,
no.
You're about to switch it. You only get one. So you gotta stick with Isaac.
I guess I'll stick with Isaac.
Okay. Because I think I know where you're going with this.
Where?
And so that's gonna be my choice.
Who would be the other one?
Well, I think it's who you think I'm gonna pick.
Go.
Jacob.
I was gonna go with Joseph.
Yeah.
But
Joseph?
I was gonna go with Joseph.
Joseph, the father of Jesus?
No, Joseph.
Stepfather?
Not Joseph. Is that Joseph of Arimathea?
Uh-huh. Very good, Rabuni.
I took Christianity in rabbinical school. Okay. No, I was going to go with Joseph just because the reconciliation.
You don't get it.
Okay, I guess I
can. You don't get it.
Okay,
you
so
can't.
Jacob. Why Jacob?
Jacob, because as a father, I get a kid who's going to show up, who's going to put in 14 years of hard labor. Now, with all these kids who are running around just trying to do you-know-what with you-know-who and trying to get it and... You know, guys these days, you were once upon a guy. They're only after one thing. And now you get to test this guy and know if he's just truly trying to get in my daughter's pants or if he's really just trying to marry her. And he's going to stick around for 14 years. And not only stick around for 14 years, but also work my ground. I'm going to be like, yeah, I trust this guy. I trust this guy with my daughter. I mean, even if he did it for 7 years, man, even if he did it for 7 months, you know, a man, we're talking about a man. We all know how men think. We think about one thing when you're in your teenage years. And if you're going to show up and you're in love with my daughter, and I'm going to say, you know, you don't even get to hold her hand for the next 7 months.
I like that because, you know, what Jacob does too is that he seemingly starts from nothing and he makes Laban, is his father-in-law, a very wealthy man.
Uh-huh.
And he increases his flock almost like tenfold. I like that. I like that.
You got to, you know, to get earned the trust of a boy, of a teenage boy, or however old is. I mean, for someone to put in that much time, you're like, yeah, I trust you with my daughter.
And okay, so on the flip side, which figure would you say, I don't want you,
David?
I don't want you David, 10 feet from my house.
David, run the other way, buddy. I don't care who you are, how many horses you have, okay, how much money you have. No way. I'd rather have her become a nun.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I would look at it the same way, not with David, but with David's son of Solomon.
Yeah.
Because I don't want my daughter to be a 1001 of just another random person. You know, if you're going to have 1,000 wives. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I would be skeptical and dubious about it.
So even if she would rather have her just be broke and, let's say, just the poor, as opposed to being, let's say, she's lavishly taken care of, though. And she's 1 of 1,000, but she's part of the royal court. And she gets everything she ever wanted, all free health care, you know, free child, any car she wants to take out of the palace. She's really well taken care of, but she's just going to get 1/1,000th of husband time. Mm-hmm. You say it's better for her to just kind of more live on welfare and hopefully be happy and mm-hmm. have a guy who just totally loves her and mm-hmm. devoted to her. Mm-hmm. Good answer there. All right. So how about this? Who would let's go with what would be your presidential ticket? Or do you want to think about that? And instead, I'll give you another one first.
Yeah.
Okay. Who is your best road trip partner? Anyone in the whole Bible. Who would you take on for a road trip?
I'd like to take on Mordecai.
Yeah, so talk to me, Rabbi, because I don't know much
something,
about Mordecai.
Something, you know, there's just the whole story of Purim, the story of the book of Esther. You know, Esther obviously, you know, becomes a queen. And with her uncle, you know, with Mordecai, just something about the way Mordecai, I've always had this image of Mordecai. It's just this teddy bear kind of like just engaging character that just, you know, is there and is present and is just listening and just says, you know, whatever your inner convictions are, I support you and I'm here for you. And I will try and give you everything that I have to be able to make you as successful and as passionate as possible. You know,
okay.
He supports Esther, and I think he's always there for her, and he raises her, and he.
But why does he make a good partner in the car?
Because, so I don't know. I guess nobody on the air would really know. But so when I go on road trips with my wife, and I mean no disrespect to my wife. What happens is my wife will be in the car for about 3 minutes,
fall asleep,
and then she goes, "Do you mind?" And I go, just go to sleep. Oh. And it could be like a 10-hour, 14-hour road trip.
She's
like,
out.
And she'll go to sleep.
Amazing.
Right? And a part of me says, and she'll go, do you want to listen to music? And I go, no, I'm okay. So I'll drive. Like last summer, we drove to Atlanta. And I will literally go from Stewart
without
to Atlanta.
Music?
Without music. And I'll just look at the road. Yeah,
my gosh.
Right? And I think if I had Mordecai next to me, just to kind of have that banter backwards and forwards and somebody to keep me up. And somebody to talk with me,
right?
And to hear me, and not to say that my wife doesn't hear me; she does.
Yeah, but this is thin ice here.
Really, I don't know. There's something about Mordecai that I've always really been inspired by.
Cool. No, that's well done.
And you, my friend,
Judas, he held all the purse strings. So before he screwed up and just kind of did the epic fail for the Christian people, he had all the purse strings. You need someone with money on the road trip, but it's nice that you know he's going to pay for the gas, you pay for this. So we know we got that covered. And I always want to know more about Judas. I want to know more about, we all know about the big mistake that he made, but it did lead to Jesus being crucified, which we all knew had to happen. But I want to know more about him because at a certain point, Jesus totally trusted this guy. And they all trusted him. They gave him the purse strings. And there was something, and he was chosen as 1 of the 12. So there was something good about him, and there was something likable about him, that he'd be invited into this 12-person team that Jesus was building that would then say, go out and now build disciples and make disciples. I want to know more about that. So let's go drive around the country together.
So I like the reasoning behind it. It also raises for me just, and I know we're running out of time, but just, you know, one of the questions I have is, if you could interrogate one person, which is slightly similar to what you had said, right? I want to learn more about Judas.
Yeah.
If you could interrogate one person and find out more, who would that be?
Well, I just answer that.
Okay, so the one biblical figure?
Then one biblical figure. I mean, I think a lot of people want to know the more about Judas. I mean, there's more, like there's a disciple called Thaddeus. We know really nothing about him at all. He's one of the 12, but Thaddeus, like, what's up with that? Like, I don't know if I can interrogate him. But that, I mean, I always, like, this will go back to last show, a throwback to last show. I want to go back to David and be like, what the heck were you thinking, man? You had everything. Everything was offered to you. Like, you were good. Why, there's so many fish in the sea. And if you're going to screw up, don't do it in the Oval Office. Like, just go off somewhere else and do it under wraps. And, like, that's not even cool. But, like, what your arrogance is that bad? Mm-hmm. Like, come on, man. I mean, and this is the fall of many great leaders we see. They just get so hyped up in Christian leaders and probably religious leaders. They get so hyped up on their own power that they think they can get away with anything. You know, athletes do this. Why are you driving drunk? You have enough money to pay for 18 limos because they probably got away with it many times before, right? So it's just like, stop it, man. Like, put God first. But how about you? Who do you want to interrogate? We only got a couple minutes here.
I'd like to interrogate... I'd like to interrogate Joseph.
Joseph of Arimathea. Why was Joseph he so humble to accept
Joseph
Mary with another
the
child?
The amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Okay.
I'd like to know what your thoughts were and your feelings when you were sold into slavery. And although, you know, we know the end of the story, right? The whole notion that Joseph in the end is really humble and just really grateful for his experience. I mean, he becomes the second most important person in Egypt. But a permit says, I want to know more. I want to go deeper. What are your real inner feelings? What is your real experiences that you endured? Are you really that easy to be able, you know, you're on camera, by the way. Are you really that reconcilable with the rest of your brothers?
That's good.
I'd like to learn more.
That's good. Very.
And I think that's the message
heartfelt
of this whole show that we've been doing is the quest, the search to learn more. And I think our scriptures give us the ability and the blueprints to do so. But I think that it is that constant searching and that constant ability to yearn and crave to learn more.
Learn more. Stay in it. Don't give up. God will continually to provide everything you need. If it's one thing we learned today by talking about Moses and all these leaders, even when you try to run the other way, God will not give up on you. He's going to give you the tools that you need. He's going to give you the errands in your life. He's going to stay there to stay the course. All right, everyone, we're going to see you next week. Come see my show, Jesus Was Not a Doorman, at Starstruck Theater on November 3rd at 6 p.m. Buy the tickets online. God bless you and have a beautiful weekend. Peace.